This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 20th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 230. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature. 3 million people have fled Ukraine since Vladimir Putin began his war, which was condemned by the International Court in The Hague. What does this mean for food security and energy in Europe and beyond? I welcome back supply chain and logistics expert Glenn Ross of ACC Group in Surrey, BC.
But first, is it just me?
Is it just me, or was Frank Zappa right when he called politics the showbiz wing of industry? On March 15th, former drama teacher Justin Trudeau welcomed the comedian-turned-president of Ukraine to address the House of Commons. It was an odd juxtaposition. Trudeau in a finely tailored suit in a packed House of Commons in Ottawa, the site of truckers' protests a month ago. Zelensky, in army-issue clothing, was in an office in Kyiv via web conference, pleading for the West to stop Russia from bombing innocent Ukrainians. Meanwhile, on March 16th, the BC NDP government announced it hired 3 ex-bureaucrats to review the pandemic response, except the terms of reference don't include investigating decisions of cabinet and the provincial health officer. The NDP went ahead with a public inquiry on money laundering because the problem festered under the BC Liberals. But the pandemic happened under the NDP, so Premier John Horgan doesn't want to be held accountable. The official BC body count is almost 3,000.
What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It is almost a month since Vladimir Putin used his alliance with China's Xi Jinping and the end of the Beijing Winter Olympics as a springboard to invade Ukraine. 3 million people have fled the horrors of war, condemned by the International Court in The Hague, except for judges from Russia and China. Geopolitics and economics go hand in hand. In wartime, they're thrown upside down. Joining me as a return guest, international supply chain expert Glenn Ross. He is president of ACC Group in Surrey, BC. He has turned his weekly newsletter on supply chains into a daily update on the conflict.
We heard this week President Zelensky make speeches to the Canadian Parliament, to American lawmakers, to the German lawmakers. He wants a no-fly zone to stop Russian bombing, but President Biden, the rest of NATO, they say no, that would mean World War III. So far, their biggest weapon against Russia has been sanctions and cutting Russia off from the SWIFT banking system and going after the oligarchs. Is that enough?
No, not at the moment, but I don't think that's where the focus should be, Bob. We have sanctions. We've sanctioned the major Russian banks, and we've also cut them off from SWIFT, which is more of a messaging system that allows you to conduit money around the world. There is a higher level of financial sanctions, which is applies to Iran, where they cut off anybody that deals with Russia. Now, they haven't done that yet, but that's on the cards. So to answer your question, no is not enough. From a no-fly zone, right now, I believe, this is my personal belief, that there's no-fly zone being agreed to because NATO and the USA are not ready yet. They knew that Russia was going to go into Ukraine. Biden went to Italy last year to meet, ostensibly meet the Pope as the second Roman Catholic president of the United States, but it was a cover for his meetings with the EU and NATO leaders, which led up to them being so quick to the shelf when Russia invaded Ukraine within 24 hours of its uniform and blanket sanctions against them. Now, we all know the EU doesn't make decisions that quickly, so something happened before that. And that was the American government coalescing the guys around, and they acted very quickly. Now, having said that, there's been a build-up, and I think the ferocity and the intensity of the Russian invasion and the extent of it, despite the fact that they've run short and they're falling short of what they wanted to do strategically and tactically, the intensity caught NATO and the Americans short. and they've been building up ferociously in the last 3 weeks. There are C-17 squadrons have left Connecticut and Maine. They've landed in England. They're ferrying stuff to and fro across Europe constantly. There's B-52 bombers gone into Greece, South Korea, Japan. They've gone into England and Fairford. There's F-35 Lightning fighter squadrons, which are anti-nuclear fighter jets, have been repositioned from Texas into England. There's also the Osprey helicopter stroke aeroplanes that have gone into Europe as well. And those are a very tactical weapon. They're going behind enemy lines to save you traveling on roads. So you put all this together. Yesterday, NATO had a very senior meeting, a very extraordinary meeting. Next week, Biden is to address that meeting and the EU's next week. I believe that by that time, they are going to be ready militarily, force-wise, and reinforcement-wise, and supply chain-wise. So I think watch very carefully what happens coming out of that meeting next week, that pink lines will become red lines, particularly after the Mariupol bombing of that theater with all those kids and women and children and refugees hiding away there. So I think the no-fly zone bomb may well take a different form or some form of something in the next week or 2 weeks when the West and NATO and these guys are ready for it.
Now, this all happens while Omicron is continuing to spread. It's kind of a sleeper story when people are just trying to survive and get away from guns and bombs. Pandemic takes second place, but that's going to become a bigger storyline as more people get exposed and more people get sick. There are also worries about inflation and food security. Both Ukraine and Russia are major, major wheat producers and exporters. Russia is also very important for fertilizer. This is going to have ripple effects in those countries and beyond when it comes to just feeding people. And if people aren't fed, there could be social unrest. What does this mean for global supply chains, for the most basic items, for the most basics, food and food supplies, as well as more sophisticated items?
Well, let's take them one at a time. Wheat. They really are the wheat basin for Europe, Ukraine, and Russia. And they supply into the Third World, Africa, North Africa, and the Middle East. For example, Egypt gets 70% of its wheat from that area. They subsidize bread. There's a 30% poverty rate in Egypt. If you stop supplying that poverty rate, which is subsidized, you're going to have a revolution in your hands, as is going to happen to other countries. Brazil has already signaled yesterday that they are in danger of not being able to plant for next year because they're not getting fertilizer. But even more importantly, between the two of them, there are nearly 78% of the world supply of sunflower oil. So when you go around the world, of all the canned and bottled foods around the world, which is billions of dollars, there's three ways you preserve it: olive oil, saline solution, or sunflower oil, predominantly sunflower oil. Now that's going to evaporate, which means that we have not yet seen the effect on the food supply chain of canned and bottled goods and preserved foods. Belarus, in Minsk and Brest, I was there a couple of years ago, are one of the biggest fish exporters. Despite being a landlocked country, they import fish, can it, bottle it, and then they send it around Europe. They're one of the biggest fish exporters into Europe, which is a staple element of European diets. That is stopped dead in its tracks. So to answer your question about the food supply chain, there's going to be a complete upending and rehaul. The IMF this morning issued a warning that this is going to be a global impact. Go back to your first point about the Omicron and that type of stuff. Don't forget, in China, you have the Han Chinese who rule the country and the non-Han Chinese. The non-Han Chinese have been brought in from the surrounding areas to the production areas, but they're treated as second-class citizens. It's a $2 trillion to equalize that balance that book. So China right now has got to keep trading. There's America's biggest club, if you can say that. The BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, which goes across the whole of the European continent, is their way to extend the trading routes that they have, as well as America. America's still their biggest one. If that gets shut down, China is in danger of having an internal revolution. May not happen tomorrow or the next day, but it'll certainly come. It's been exacerbated by Omicron, which has stopped the flow of cash. But more importantly, this one now, this latest outbreak, is bigger than anything else since the first Wuhan one. Already they're shutting down Tianjin port, which is the fourth largest export port in the world. Shanghai looks like they'll make a decision tomorrow morning where they're going to shut that port down. Not good news, Bob.
Yeah, we're talking about some of the most important cities for trade, for commerce, for manufacturing. Yeah, Shenzhen is another one, which is very close to Hong Kong. Hong Kong, of course, officially is the world's epicenter of the virus. They're grappling with it. In mainland China, of course, they have their COVID zero measures, and the Chinese leadership doesn't worry about anyone's civil rights. So it shut down the cities and it sent out the police to enforce this. This is going to have some major ripple effects on global trade, and maybe it'll even have some ripple effects all the way up to the leadership. Maybe Xi Jinping will look at what's happening internally and look at what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. Russia, his ally. We saw Xi and Putin sign that accord at the Beijing Olympics. This could have some very interesting effects for China today and China's ambitions. There's been a bit of an undercurrent during this whole war about whether this would cause China to think twice about its ambitions to invade Taiwan because of this international alliance that's grown very quickly to slap these sanctions and other penalties against Russia. Well, will China look at this and say, that could be us if we try Taiwan? Maybe we shouldn't try to invade Taiwan. Do you think that this could change some minds in Beijing?
Well, just go back a step to one of the first points you made about Hong Kong. The bridges into Hong Kong have been shut down because the problem in China is not just at the ports. China manufactures in the hinterland, inland, and they have these rivers, the Mekong and the Yellow, and these guys feeding the export ports. And those have all been shut down. The barges bringing containers up and down the rivers have been shut down, and the truck industry has been shut down just about. And that's where the danger lies right now. So to move on again now to Taiwan. Taiwan is different from Ukraine. Taiwan is an island. To invade Taiwan is going to take a monumental effort. They honor road bridges, they honor land bridges, everything goes by water. So the American a long time ago recognized the one China policy, which means that Taiwan is part of China. They've recognized that. But they wanted to be an autonomous one, and they sell them weapons, et cetera, which is obviously a source of angst for the Chinese. But China right now is looking at Russia, and Russia, I think, told them this is going to be a quick exposé. A little lightning raid in 72 hours, we will take back Ukraine. It hasn't happened. That has done a few things to China, in my opinion. Firstly, they've seen the coalition and the bonding of the EU and NATO, which nobody expected that. Not even the Europeans themselves expected that. Major coup for President Biden. Secondly, they've looked at the effect that the Ukrainians are having with this guerrilla warfare type stuff and the latest type of technology. Now, Taiwan and Russia both possess railguns and hypersonic missiles and things like that. But I don't think there's an appetite. China's main and only goal is the survival and thriving of China. Russia to China is nothing more than a means to an end, even though they've got 800 miles on the Trans-Siberian Railway line as one of their three rail lines. So I don't think China's patience with Russia is going to last too much longer. Russia made them a promise, I believe, that they were going to go in and out and solve the problem. Ask China wait until after, or China asked them wait until after the Olympics. We don't want any upsetting there. It hasn't happened. Plus, the reaction of the world has also been a surprise to both Russia and to China, I believe. So I don't think there's any chance right now of a nuclear war. I think they all realize that they may posture, but I don't think they're going to do it. And I don't think China's going to look at any intentions of going and invading Taiwan for the foreseeable future.
And finally, a lot of Canadians are watching this. There's a lot of Canadians who have Ukrainian backgrounds in their families. They're either from Ukraine or they've got Ukrainian blood from generations past. There are other Canadians, though, that may not be paying as much attention to this, and they may not pay attention until it hits them in the pocketbook. We've seen gas prices, of course, increase. What about for those Canadians who may finally wake up and be concerned once it does hit their pocketbook? Where should we see more impacts in the weeks and months to come on Main Street?
Look for the food chain. The food chain is dependent, obviously, on fertilizer, potash, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest potash exports in the world come out of that region that's currently in conflict. So we're not going to see an impact next week or the week afterwards. but look for the grain belts and the produce and fruit producing areas, South America, Africa, Asia, that export into North America and Canada in particular. Now, we have our own wheat fields up in the prairies and things like that, but a lot of it's indirectly affected. So if Brazil is now saying, and Nicaragua is saying, and the South American countries are saying, look, we don't have any stuff to plant in the ground. We need to plant them now in the next 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, you look at Bayer. Bayer this morning announced that they will continue supplying supplies into Russia because they can't afford to jeopardize the 2023 harvest. Russia is the wheat belt. It is a fundamental element of supply into the rest of the world. That's all going to be jeopardized. So some of these countries are saying, with the blessing of America and NATO, continue to export into Russia because it's for global survival. We need to make sure they keep producing because they're such an instrumental part of the global food chain. So look for that. Inflation, I think, will go close to 10%. I think de facto it's there already. America, I predicted 8 months ago, would be up around about 6.75. They're now at 7%. So I think inflation is going to go up. Obviously, we know that's driven by gas and the price of oil, even though it's coming down slightly. I think the posturing by the Russian government that they want to do peace talks, I think, is nothing more than a false flag. They're trying to regroup because they've been knocked senseless by the Ukrainians. But again, Bob, watch for next week, what Biden and NATO announce.
That was international supply chain expert Glenn Ross of the ACC Group in Surrey, BC. Go to accgroupco.com for more information.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Xi considered invading Taiwan this fall, said FSB whistleblower. Xi Jinping had considered launching an invasion of Taiwan in the fall of this year around the Chinese Communist Party Congress before the window of opportunity closed with the disastrous Russian invasion of Ukraine. The head of the Russian human rights group Gulagu.net, Vladimir Osechkin, recently on Facebook began releasing documents containing Russian intelligence concerning the war in Ukraine. Also in the Taiwan news, British man who tattooed Taiwan on his forehead releases book. Paul Farrell's Taiwan Tattoo recounts 17 years of travel in Asia, including 14 years off and on in Taiwan. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Hong Kongers want cash more than the 10,000 Hong Kong dollar shopping coupons amid worsening COVID outbreak. The Democratic Party's Ramon Yuen said spending vouchers will encourage citizens to go out and make purchases, which goes in the opposite direction of the government's social distancing measures. COVID-19 social distancing measures have affected some sectors more than others. The unemployment rate of workers in the food and beverage sector surged by 1.9 percentage points to 8.1%, while 8.2% of those in the entertainment and recreation sector lost their jobs, a sharp increase of 2.9 percentage points. In Mainichi News, ex-Hiroshima mayor urges Putin not to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Former Hiroshima mayor Tadatoshi Akiba urged Russian President Vladimir Putin not to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. He said the victims of the 1945 U.S. atomic bombings on Hiroshima and Nagasaki went through a living hell and despicable reality. They somehow managed to survive and urged leaders of nuclear states to visit the two cities to learn about the damage a nuclear attack can bring.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, raid of Salem home turns up what feds suspect is largest ghost gun manufacturing operation found in state. Agents from the U.S. Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives working with Salem police seized 63 guns from the home on Tuesday in what they believe is the largest ghost gun manufacturing enterprise found in Oregon. The guns and gun parts were found amid approximately 200 counterfeit blue M30 OxyContin pills, suspected to be made from potent fentanyl, along with a small quantity of suspected heroin, according to court records. Ghost guns are untraceable, with their parts typically bought online and assembled at home. They also lack commercial serial numbers. In the Spokane Spokesman Review, former State Representative Matt Shea takes part in rescue of 62 orphans from Ukrainian city
now ravaged by bombs, but some are questioning Shea's actions and children's future. Shea is a former state representative from Spokane Valley who was kicked out of the State House Republican caucus after investigators determined that his role in the armed takeover of an Oregon wildlife refuge in 2016 amounted to an act of domestic terrorism against the United States. Shea denied allegations of having plans to whisk the children to the U.S. or bring them harm, calling the criticism Russian propaganda. He addressed the controversy on a Polish church YouTube channel, Against the Tide TV, which was founded by far-right Polish pastor Paweł Czojecki. In the Victoria Times columnist, new owners of fabled Grouse Nest Resort in East Souk offer refuge to fleeing Ukrainians. Brian and Sharon Holowaychuk had been planning to reopen Grouse Nest as a resort. Their plans changed when Russia invaded Ukraine. The 33 hectares of secluded wilderness with its moss-shrouded rainforest and hundreds of meters of waterfront is about as far as it's possible to get from the tanks, artillery fire, and upheaval driving millions of Ukrainian people from their homes. The property was once owned by an Egyptian millionaire from Switzerland who spent a fortune refurbishing the lodge in 1964. Some mid-century celebrities spent time there, including John Wayne and Lorne Greene. Later, there were rumors the owner's family used it as a secure getaway to avoid Israeli intelligence agents who were pursuing his involvement in weapons development.
And it don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Francophones of British Columbia, also known as Colombie Britannique. March 20th is International Francophone Day. Be proud of French heritage. A special bonjour to all Francophones listening to the podcast. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Show me, bracia, kozac, korona.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 20th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 20th of March in 1985, wheelchair athlete Rick Hansen began his Man in Motion World Tour at Oak Ridge Center in Vancouver, and Libby Riddles became the first woman to win Alaska's Iditarod Sled Dog Race. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews.
Until next week.